I mean, my big passions are, you know, helping transitioning veterans and military spouses, you know, find employment, whether it's while they're leaving the service or, you know, I just talked to a guy who he's been out of the military about 8 years or so, and he's struggling. You know, and so I, one of my traditional calls of just talking about, you know, resources and networking and stuff, that was, it almost turned into kind of more of a counseling session of, yeah, you know, hey, I'm there. I understand. I didn't grow up in a perfect household either. You know, life was hard, but you know, life's the choices you make out of it. You know, you can either sit there and be a victim, or you could, you know, learn from those mistakes and don't repeat them.
But David, you know, your bio here says you're a proven operations leader excelling in fast-paced, rapidly changing environments. And I can see you're in the Navy, and now you're at the Bank of America, two very patriotic organizations. Tell us, for our audience, a little bit more about yourself.
So a little bit about myself. I originally enlisted out of high school in the Navy as a yeoman. Spent 4 years on active duty enlisted, and then got picked up for an officer program. You know, I applied, they saw enough in me, they gave me an opportunity, and I went through the boost program. They sent me to ROTC unit at Florida A&M, Florida State, earned my degree. And while I was there, they said, hey, do you want to fly in? Do you want to fly in the backseat of aircraft? I was like, heck yeah, because the other jobs the Navy has are not that great, in my opinion. So I lucked into an amazing career field. Flight school for me was a year and a half of probably the hardest schooling I ever went through, because I'm not naturally smart. I never planned and dreamed of being an aviator. You know, so I was learning everything on the fly. But you know, it became a dream. I had a goal, I achieved it. And spent the last 15 years of my military career flying in the backseat of the mighty P-3 Orion, an anti-submarine warfare aircraft, looking for subs primarily, but we also spent a lot of time overland, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Somalia, you know, supporting troops on the ground. You know, and after retiring back in 2019 in December, I joined Bank of America through a veteran development program, which, you know, they take about roughly 25 veterans a year. And you know, I interviewed with about 80 different veterans as well, and got picked for the program. It's a 2-year rotational where I try, two different roles in the bank. And while I'm trying those roles, I also learn, network, and meet other people in other areas of the bank to find out where my fit is. You know, so unfortunately, unlike the military where you just pick a job and like, you hope it works out, you know, I'm getting to try a couple things, dabble a couple things. You know, I could stay in one of the ones I'm in, or I could move to something completely different when the program's over.
I've heard a lot of stories, and there's obviously a common theme around folks trying to transition from the military into civvy life, private sector. What are a couple of myths you can bust for us right now?
So the biggest myths are, you know, get away from the stereotypical, you know, don't think you're just, you know, one of the biggest myths for me was like the HR department. You know, if you watch TV, you know, you just think of like three things they do: hire, fire, and discipline. You know, but as I started my journey and I did what's called informational interviews, I talked to veterans at companies. I asked, was like, hey, what do you do? How did you get there? Tell me more. You know, that's when I learned that, you know, HR is more than that. I didn't realize the training department was under this HR in the civilian sector. I also, before I even went to Bank America, I was like, I don't know if I really want to go to Bank America. I don't want to be a teller. I don't want to sell products as a financial advisor. You know, and that's when, guess what? My network, I reached out to one of my peers that I served with in the Navy, who was at Bank America. I was like, hey, man, you've been there for 5 years. I know you joined that program. You know, tell me about the program. Tell me about your experience. You're a smart guy and you're still there. You know, and that's when I learned, you know, here in Jacksonville, Florida, it's a hub and headquarters for operations and technology, all the behind the scenes stuff. You know, so I don't deal with customers. I deal with I deal with solutions, problems, and supporting frontline customers or frontline associates that are dealing with customers.
That's interesting. Now, what I'm going to do, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought, because Heather, let's hear from you. And I think you've got experience that straddles private sector and military. And let's throw the same question at you as well about myth busting.
Myth busting. That was actually my son's favorite show for quite a number of years. I'm Heather Coons. For those of you that don't know, I'm the Chief Development Officer at DOL Coach, and I get to work with a fabulous team of trainers and with my fabulous co-leader, Scott Kinder. That's an experience all in itself. Good times though. Yeah, I do have experience on both sides of the military civilian fence, if you will. I was a military spouse for almost two decades, and really was fortunate enough the last couple of years in that role as a spouse, but also to function in the role of advisor to the command for Marine Special Operations Regiment as a family readiness officer and program manager. So, David, I got the experience too of helping transitioning military and spouses. Kind of, we're leaving the service now. We have no idea what we're going to do with our life, or who's going to take care of us, or what that looks like, or what our support resources are. And to me, it was always almost criminal that service members do not, even when they're in the service, have an idea and understanding of every resource that there is to support them. And when they get out, there's still a whole slew of support and organizations and government agencies and civilian organizations and people like yourself that just want to help. So it's very sad to see people struggle so much when they transition into civilian life, right? And there's so much experience that people have. What I love about DOL Coach is we have that opportunity to, you know, put people through our basic course, and they learn that what they've been doing in the military actually translates to the civilian world in project management, but nobody told them what they were doing all those years, right? So I don't know, myths, Angus. I think from my experience, I think a lot of people feel like they have to do everything on their own. And if they can't do it on their own, then they're not strong or worthy or valuable. And I think as a society, we expect our service members to be able to just carry on, you know, like, oh, you're fine. You've done all that hard stuff. This is easy, but it's not. And so I think that's a myth that has to be busted, if you will, that people are made to rely and help each other, rely on each other and support each other. And I think that we, through COVID, I think we've come to realize that there is a real need for community and support. And I think it's going to help actually become a silver lining of this whole situation, that people are like, I need my people and I need to be with people and help people. And that's part of my job as a person, you know? So I don't know if that really answered your question. I didn't mean to wax on, but that's what I have to say about that.
This is something I've been thinking about for a couple of years, because I remember the first time when I left a long time ago, right? No help, zero help. And also no one gets help, right? You're a civvy, you start as a civvy, you go organization to organization. No one gets help transitioning from college to work to work, anything like that in life. Now, gonna put a little underpinning caveat. I acknowledge Veterans Day every year, Remembrance Sunday. In overseas, it's not a holiday, but it's the one date in the year that I've always had a time to reflect and a moment's silence everywhere I've been in the world, because I think what veterans do is so important. But the reason I'm going to ask you both this question: why do we need to help veterans transition?
I would say the biggest thing is, you know, for a lot of people do get those help. You know, if they go to college, there are career centers. There is a little bit of job coaching. You know, people can reach out for coaches if they want. There is a little bit of that, but I think the veteran community needs it so bad is because, you know, we've been so focused on training, readiness, and deployment for so long that we did a job and you know, we need to be able to translate those skills to go find something else. You know, I have never written a resume. You know, I was with the Navy for 25 years. My first resume I wrote when I was, I don't know, roughly 42, 43 years old. You know, I never filled out more than an application or did a simple interview in the restaurant industry, you know, as a server, bartender, or whatever, you know, when I was in high school and college. It's a whole nother ball game going into, you know, leaving out. And I think a lot of this really came from is the pure facts from the Department of Labor. I mean, look at the unemployment rate after Vietnam. Look at the unemployment rate just probably 10 years ago, prior to the Gulf War. The veteran unemployment rate was double, if not triple, than the national average. So they identified there's a problem. Like, hey, these veterans are getting out. Like, you know, think of an infantry guy. Like, you know, you're not going to go guard. There's not a lot of jobs to go guard things or you know, put those skills to good use. When you get out, it's kind of frowned upon, you know, if you're shooting people or, you know, taking offensive action. So there was definitely identified a reason that it needs help. You know, and just being able to translate skills that don't have anything to do with the military to the civilian world, it was identified issue.
What do you think, Eric? Is at DOL, what would you say, 80%, 90% of us have got some kind of military impact in our background? You, as a business leader, you've got really right there through the lens of the pluses and minuses of all of them.
Yeah, you know, in my younger adult life, I had a lot of friends that, okay, most of my friends were military spouses, right? And everybody but me, and I think one other person from our friend group lived on base. Their kids went to school on base. I taught school on base. And I could see that we never lived on a base. So for 20 years, we never lived on a base. We always lived out in town. So I felt more connected to my community. But those people and those families that never leave a base, they work there, they live there, they go to school there, their friends are there, and then they have to leave and go back into be in the real world. It's like, it's a totally different world. There's not, you know, it's not safe anymore because there's no police patrolling the base. You know, you're out in the real world. There's, you know, no special grocery store. There's no special like school. There's no special health clinic anymore. You're out into the real world, and it can be such a challenge and such a struggle. I think that's why veterans need so much help, Angus, to go back to your earlier question, because they've either been told what to do their entire adult life, orders, you follow orders, or they've been giving orders to people that follow their orders. And that doesn't happen in the civilian world. Like, there's discussion, there's community, there's, you have to grow and struggle and challenge and work with other people that you might not want to work with. So I think it's just a completely disparate lifestyle, especially for career military, to try to figure out how to be on their own, independent, with a completely different or minimal support system. So that's one thing. And then for DOL Coach, I think my goal is to really push deeply into the civilian sector and kind of continue to bolster support and interact with the military community. But we need to pull our military people into the civilian community and then support them there and say, yes, thank you for your service, but your life is still 2/3 ahead of you. And there's so much more than just what you did. And I'm not devaluing military experience or anything like that, but it is, you know, you're still young, David. I'm pretty sure that you don't say to yourself every day, oh, self, I wish I was still in the Navy because I don't know what to do with my life. You know, that was the best time of my life. Now my life is over. Like, I'm sure that's not what you think about every day. But I think a lot of our people do. I mean, my son is an Air Force veteran, if you will. I mean, he only served for 6 years. He has PTSD. He has 90% disability rating. He is 27 years old and has no idea what he's going to do with the rest of his life. he's just struggling. And he wasn't even a career veteran, you know? So I can see the struggle from a personal and a professional level, if that contributes to the conversation at all.
Yeah. And that also equates to other points. Like, you know, one, some people kind of get institutionalized, you know, they're insulated on the base, you know, they're not giving, like, you get one shopping, you got one grocery store on the base, you know, you get on the real world, you know, there's probably 30 within a 15-mile radius. So like, which one do you go to? Now you're given choices. You know, and on top of that, you know, Heather, like your son, I talk to so many people and I hate it when they say, well, I only did 7 years, or I only was an E5. You know, I was like, everyone's service is the same. It should be valued the same. I don't care what your rank is. I don't care how many years you are. As long as you did an honorable service, you know, your time. You know, I at one point I was thinking of getting out at 4 years. You know, did one tour. I was going to possibly do a second tour. And then, hey, you know, if I don't get what I want, I'm getting out, going to college, you know, because I could not see myself being enlisted for a 20-year career. That was just me. But, you know, that's example right there is, you know, we come in, we're kind of told what to do. We're given very tight left and right boundaries on this is your job and this is what you're going to do. And now when you get out, it's like, well, there's too many choices. Where do I turn? And that's why a lot of veterans struggle, because, you know, in ways they're starting 5, 10, 20 years after their peers that have been in the civilian world and built a career, and they're coming in as like, well, I did 10, 20 years. I don't want to start entry level again. You know, you got to find something with a niche that's, you know, the right point to join a company.
You know, I just finished this book that was about, it was set right after World War II, and it was down in Key West, and all of these service members had come back from the war and been sent to camps down in Key West to work on building highways and train tracks from connecting different islands, and because Washington didn't want to deal with all of these people that had done all the service, been promised all these things, come back, and people were protesting, and they just said, you know what, we're just going to move them out of sight, out of mind. Let's put them down in Florida where no one will see them and bother them. And they lived in squalid tents. They, you know, did not have any medical care. It's the swamps of Florida. And they were just dying of malaria and cholera and dysentery. And it's like, you go to serve your country, they expect to be paid when they get back and have services provided. And instead they're just shuffled down. And then tragedy, this is based off of a true story. So then tragedy is hurricane comes, wipes all the camps away and kills thousands. And then it's like, okay, problem solved, which is not what I say, but that was the premise in the story in this book. And I thought, it's not so dissimilar. Our Vietnam veterans came back to a society that didn't want them, right? Because it was such a divided ideal. And people come back from service now and it's like, oh, you're fine. There's nothing wrong with you. You know, that the whole PTSD issue doesn't really exist because I can't see it. So therefore it's not real. You know, that kind of feeling and sentiment really, really bothers me. So when I see people like yourself helping people and building networks and helping them grow that community, I know that you get it. I hope a lot of people that listen to this are like, oh, I never thought of it that way. And this is why we need to support them. So yes.
And it's a lot of the, one of the myths or some, for whatever reason, you know, most people, I'm going to say in general, are type A personalities. You know, they're all gung ho. They all love the mission. They all want to get the job done, and they forget, or they don't realize, like, you know, we did everything as a team. You know, we did our missions, we did our training, we did everything as a team. But then when they go into transition and they know they're leaving the service by themselves, the team's there, but they're leaving by themselves. Somehow they forget, like, well, I think I'm all, you know, I no longer have a team anymore. But that's where we try to get to their heads. It's like, look, there's an entire community of veterans that are already out that want to help, you know, because I've heard the horror stories of, you know, the Vietnam veterans, you know, with no services. I've heard 10 years ago, there was nothing compared to what's around, available now with things like DLL Coach and all the all the certification programs and all the transition courses, you know, none of that was around, none of that was available. And they struggled. They just kind of got a 2-day course and said, hey, here's, you know, Department of Labor, you know, good luck, have fun, you know. And, you know, we built a community with a lot of resources, a lot of 501Cs, you know, supporting people and saying, hey, you're not alone. You know, we're here. All you have to do is reach out and say, hey, I need a little help. You know, I need a little guidance. You know, I had a friend in one of the transition courses I did with Operation New Uniform. Said he had been out for a little while, and he said he applied to 1,000 jobs and didn't get one single interview. And then you peel back the onion, you're, well, how did that happen? What sectors did you go in? Finds out he never got any help. He had been applying to every single job with the same resume. It didn't matter if it was project management, HR, recruiting, IT. He used the exact same resume of what he did in the military and not tailor his resumes to what he wants to do post-military. You know, and watching a guy like that struggle, that's why I want to get him early and say, hey, guys, you know, brand before your resume. You know, writing a resume is great, but if you don't know what you want to do, you don't know what to write your resume towards.
But don't you think that's part of the problem, is that people don't know what they want to do?
Like, that is part.
I mean, even in college, I'm like, I don't know if I really want to be a teacher, but I don't know what else I want to do because I have no life experience. Right. So you just fall back. Well, my mom's a teacher. She seems to like it. I guess I'll do that. But if you don't know, I think that's an interesting thing about society. And Angus, you've lived all over the place. And I just think here, it's like you make a choice of what you're going to do with your life before you have the skills and the knowledge to actually make that choice.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because I've had a few discussions just about the people I'm helping coach on a one-to-one. And the thing that's coming up is around societal expectations. So we perform to the base of societal expectations to make our teachers happy or our parents happy, you know, behave well, get a job or leave school, go to college or leave school, get a job, get married, get a mortgage. That sort of slightly entrenched societal expectation, it transcends all societies. So with that sort of blueprint laid down for you, it's very hard to step left or right of center of that without ruffling people's feathers and causing anxiety. So what that does to my mind is it funnels us into this sort of the message I hear over here a lot is that the American phrase is stay in your lane, you know, which is to me, it's quite ironic because we sort of on the one hand speak to people like, be an identity, be yourself, right? We're in a democracy, so be a free thinker. And yet at the same time you go, but don't do this, don't do that. And don't, you know, we have this culture of no that underpins that kind of human desire to explore and grow. And yeah, and I listening to you guys speak, when I decided that I'm going to leave the military, when I decided I went into the military, like I lost a bunch of friends. And I said, why would you do that? What's wrong with staying here? And then when I left, I lost another bunch of friends going, why are you leaving? And I was going, well, there's opportunities out there. And then when I left the country, left the motherland to go and work overseas. So there's like three in a very short time frame in my own life, there was three relocation and dislocation experiences that I fundamentally had to manage on my own, which is why I'm very actually coming back to my early question and flushing out some of my own mild hypocrisy, which is I'm actually very keen on coaching and helping people transform because I don't want anyone to go through that kind of pain because it's horrible, but I don't always know how to articulate it. So I'm going to throw that one back at you, David.
So I'm a big Dave Ramsey follower. You know, I follow the baby steps. I think it's one of the things that helped me with my transition that, you know, I'm now on baby step 6. You know, I also built an emergency fund or a war fund, you know, for my transition so that, you know, I've got 3 to 6 months of expenses. Heaven forbid, like, I don't get a job, you know, because some of the worst things I've seen is guys just take jobs because they got to pay bills and then they're not happy. You know, it's a job. So I luckily found a career, which is something I can see doing myself for a long time. But I completely agree about the societal hypocrisy. It's like I tell people all the time, like, do what you want to do. And what Dave Ramsey talks about is as you're going through the process of getting out of debt, you know, societal norms say, you know, get a car, you'll always have a car payment. Well, I haven't had one in going on 7, 8, 9 years now, you know, because I don't have to have a new car and I definitely don't lease. You know, if you listen to society, you're wrong. What he talks in there is every time you start to leave the herd tries to pull you back. But like, no, don't you got to stay with us, you know, because this is normal. This is what we're used to. You know, we're afraid of change. You know, and I'm a perfect example. I am at least the first male in 3 generations to go to college, let alone get 2 bachelor's and a master's. My wife is the first, she'll only be the second, at least female, if not anybody, to have a master's in her side of the family. Like we both came from very blue collar, you know, tough, you know, type of people. And we decided to go a different path and kind of go more white collar, get an education, you know, and some of our family said, why are you going to college? It's a waste of time. It's just a piece of paper. I'm like, yeah, but that piece of paper helped me open doors that weren't available to me without that piece of paper. So leaving societal norms and pulling away, it's very hard because it's scary. I was petrified when I was enlisted and I was offered the opportunity to become an officer. You know, I'm a 19-year-old kid. They're about to send me to college and put me in charge. And I'd never been in charge. I always wanted to be in charge, but I was never the captain of the football team or wrestling. I was, you know, never valedictorian. I was never the lead of any clubs or programs in high school. I was a part of a lot of things and I would love to have been in a leadership position, but the Navy saw the potential in me and was offering it to me. And I almost turned it down because I was scared, because I would have left the herd, you know, and that's, it's hard sometimes, but it's things we have to fight against and realize, like, big picture wise, is what I'm going to do going to make my life better and my family's life better? Or is it better to not take a chance, you know, and just stay in the comfort zone? Because, you know, some of those people in the comfort zone, they don't ever want to fail. They don't want to make a decision and be held responsible for their failures. But I tell them all the time, like, you know, look at the richest people in the world, Bezos, you know, Elon Musk, you know, the Schultz, the guy from, you know, Starbucks. They've failed a ton, but they learned from those failures and they excelled. Not everything they've ever done. Steve Jobs got fired from his own company and brought back on. And before he came back on the second time, they were a struggling computer company. Now they're a phone company that makes computers.
Yeah. And right there, David, is this whole thing about, we sort of love it when other people do it, but stepping off the cliff, if you like, and it does sometimes feel like we've got to step off a cliff and to discover that it's actually just a curbstone. So how do we, and it sort of resonates with coming from institute, like, you know, coming out of the military into civvy, or going from civvy into the military. I think there's common emotions there, and going from one country to another country and having to experience that culture. I talk about this jokingly, because I spent 12 years living in a communist country, and I'm not a communist, and I didn't become a communist, by the way. I sort of feel like I'm still true to my roots. But when I was over there, I just learned a lot about humanity and a lot about society. And humanity is a lot deeper than, if you like, what our political or cultural book covers are, you know. So I want to ask you both a question then. What's one of the most common fallacies, let's say, from either going Let's pick on the civilians for a while. What do we hear from civilians that might be a bit underinformed or ignorant about military people that we can adjust their expectations on?
Oh, that one could be easy. I mean, two of the biggest fallacies is that everybody's got PTSD and they're broken, which could be the farther from the truth. I mean, that is only a small percentage of the population, and they're not all completely broken. And, you know, the majority of us are well-adjusted people that have just normal issues, just like anybody else. And the other one would be like, they think that we are too single focused or only have one mind and aren't creative and aren't open to opportunities, you know, with no creativity because you were told what to do your whole life. Like, well, actually in the Navy, you know, if somebody tells us an unlawful order, as we would say, we can tell them no. You know, they don't realize that we could do that. You know, it happens. You know, we can challenge authority, but, you know, they think we're all robots that are broken with PTSD when we could be farther from the truth.
I think they all think that you're robots that carry weapons and kill people and break in doors when there are so many other careers and MOSs in the military. I mean, there are some extremely gifted financial managers and administrative gurus, and there are people that write policy, programs, procedures. Like, there's so many things that are different. I worked with some really excellently multifaceted, talented people in Special Operations Regiment that were deeply involved in like wounded warrior communities and helping people transition, but the medical community, the Navy corpsmen attached to the Marine Corps, were so smart and well-rounded and did so many things and were so deeply embedded into all of these things. I mean, there's translators, there's so many things that are happening. And I don't think that people realize that the 1 or 2% of people that serve have this vast body of knowledge and experience that they can bring back into the civilian sector. They're not all gunslingers, you know? So I think they're like, oh, it's like the Civil War. Everyone runs around shooting and fighting, right? It's like, no, there's so much more to military service than that. So I think that's a big fallacy.
It all goes back to the same things I had about, you know, working at a bank and or the HR community. You know, it's everything we see on TV, you know, which molds our thoughts and images and you know, where some might be true, but it's only a small portion. And, you know, not every veteran thinks the same. You know, the greatest thing about being in the military, you know, is the fact that we get people from every race, culture, color, creed, religion coming together, putting aside their differences, finding commonalities, and getting a mission done. You know, and if the rest of the country or the world could understand that, it would make this whole world a better place.
If they could do that.
Yes.
Outside.
But they're not, the civilian world is not forced to come together. You know, unfortunately, you know, politics and all that stuff that happened a long time ago, you know, communities are divided by streets, by zip codes, by a multitude of things, and they don't enough go into each other's areas. You know, one of the greatest things I learned in the military is appreciation of other people's cultures. So, you know, I love going to different ethnic group festivals because I love food, and there are some amazing food around the world where I have in-laws that if it's not steak and potatoes, they think it's weird, or if it's not fried. And I'm like, you're missing out. Like, sushi is one of the most amazing things in the world. You know, it's, oh, but I won't eat raw fish. I'm like, well, you're missing out on some amazing foods, you know, with being in the Mediterranean, being in the Middle East, being in Asia, being in Africa, you know, in South America. Like, the foods are so diverse that I take it a pleasure to learn other people's culture, especially through food.
And David, you've touched on one of my favorite subjects, which is food, basically. Somewhere up the top with rugby, food and rugby. But food is, and if you think about, way back in biblical times, talk about breaking bread together, but food and language are probably the two most common gateways to any culture. It gives you empathy and understanding with people. So what do you think about what David just said, Heather, and how do we make people more sophisticated in their outlook?
I think we should just have a lot of dinner parties.
Potluck.
Potlucks. I agree with what you said though. I mean, it really, fellowship and food, you know, and hanging out together and deepening friendships. There's a lot of conversation that happens around a table. And there's a lot of you know, even going back to Thanksgiving is coming, right? You think about the pilgrims and the Indians, and they're sitting around the table and they're sharing their different foods and they're building a common ground. And I feel like that's still a worthy portrayal of, you know, Thanksgiving, you know, Friendsgiving. I made a Thanksgiving feast for 13 friends and they all brought a guest. And I have this little house and we had 23 people, most of whom didn't know each other, just sharing food and talking. And it was like this beautiful evening of just celebrating who we are as disparate people, right? And I didn't know half of them from Adam when they came in the door. And then it's like, I think that is such a key piece. I know I don't see my family much because we're spread all over the country. I've never lived near my mom since I was 17. My dad lives in a different part of the country. You know, all of my kids are spread out. And just the idea of, and the excitement of getting together and having a meal at Christmas or Thanksgiving or in the middle of the summer just fills you with warmth and happiness. And I think the right food does that too. And I don't think I'm answering your question at all, Angus, but you know, holidays are coming. We're thinking about this now.
So but you both got me thinking, if you look at like military and people who play a sport where they're being coached, so sort of, and that can be amateur through to professional, and mm-hmm. expatriate environments, you're sort of in this concentrated evolution or forced development, if you like, where you're having to change your shape emotionally, mentally, and let's stay away from the military piece for a bit, but as an expatriate, and one of the things, Heather, you just said, one of the things when I was overseas was I loved going out for dinner with people, right? I loved it. It was like, it was one of the things I was happy to leave back in the UK, because everyone's stuck in the front of the TV, right? Don't talk, don't eat dinner together. And then we were in Shanghai at the time, there was a couple of million expatriates. So you could be sitting at dinner with multiple nationalities. Right, English, American, Canadian, French, Spanish, Chilean, Argentinian. So you have to sort of get along, right? And there's no room for being entrenched in your ideas, because someone around that table is going to call you out. So you're sort of you're either in a forced evolutionary state or you're going to be very lonely. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something there that maybe military folks could seek or do seek, but we've in our own domestic environments may have gone missing. What do you think?
So I'd definitely say that, because one of the biggest complaints I get from people that have gotten out is they miss the team aspect. They having that group of people that care about the same mission, because it's a foreign idea to veterans that, you know, we all knew what each other got paid. There was no disparity. There was no, you know, men get paid more than women, or, you know, one race gets paid more than another race. Like, everybody knew what everybody got paid, and everybody got paid the same, you know, so we didn't worry about pay. But I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought for a second. That's not always the same on the outside. You know, and so the motivating factor inside was the mission, whereas the motivating factor I see at times is pay. You know, it's not the mission of the company. It's like, what are you going to pay me today? Are you going to give me a raise? That sort of stuff. So going from a team aspect to a more selfish aspect in ways can be eye-opening. Whereas, you know, we cared more about, you know, is the mission done? And hey, do we get to get off early on Friday? That'd be awesome. Let's all work hard together so we can get off early. Whereas here, you know, ask people, you push people a little too hard and you ask them to, you know, put in a little extra effort. And, you know, if they put a little extra effort and they can get off early on Friday, they just take the day off, you know? So why even worry about the goal? I'm just going to take the day off. And it's just that team aspect, you know, for some is very hard, you know, and I learned through this, like, just change my focus, my mission. Like, you know, yeah, I'm going to follow the company's mission, but at the same time, I just want to be a shining example to my coworkers, you know, be light, bubbly, you know, be available and, you know, make them happy. And I'm a big believer. You make everybody happy around you and everybody's happy. Everybody works harder and everybody, you know, gets along.
Here's something then. Excuse my ignorance. Has the US ever had conscription? I think Vietnam, there was conscription.
Yes. So there was a draft. There's conscription. I don't know how far it went back. I want to say at least World War One, all the way through Vietnam. And then some point, I want to say after Vietnam, it became an all voluntary service.
Yeah. I think the UK was the same around about the 50s that conscription stopped. So when you choose to serve, it's a choice. Yeah. But I've often wondered about that as well, because it took me a while to get. I look back at my time, third generation law enforcement family. I chose to do something different, which was have a crack at the military, then get a degree, similar to yourself, David. But I know, I think still in parts of Europe, some countries, they do have, you have to do service, right? And you don't have to be in the military. You can do it civil service in a hospital or a fire service or whatever. But I've toyed with that over the years, because it's like, it's a good way to know that you're going to get annually new employees coming in. You know, it can help you evolve other people's careers. But equally, I think it's good for people to spend a year, 18 months, just to give of themselves to another environment. And do you think, if either of you, is there any value to that kind of national service?
Absolutely. Yes. So President Bush's son actually suggested a conscription service of some sort. And he didn't say you had to join the military. It was like, you know, join the military, Peace Corps, some sort of volunteer service. You know, like you said, for 18 months, a year. That's one of the things I've really, really liked about, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the UK has this kind of like gap year thing for a lot of people that leave high school and go to college. I saw both the princes do it, and that's when I learned about it. Prince Harry and Prince William. William, thank you. You know, they did a year in Africa or did their volunteer service. And I was like, well, that's interesting. So I'm all about it, because being in the military, and I was truly affected when I was stationed in Djibouti, Africa. I was there during Christmas time. The Harlem Globetrotters were coming to the base for a USO show, which was awesome. But they grabbed a bunch of orphans from out in town and brought them on base to bring them to the show, you know, to just entertain them and everything. But they came in and ate at the chow hall with us, and it kind of broke my heart, because it was something I hadn't witnessed itself, is, you know, the eating of hands with hands without utensils, you know, the way they do it over there. Also, you know, after they got done eating with hands, they went to go look, the guy was looking at his cup of water, his drinking water, and he thought he was going to use that to wash his hands off and not the napkins that was provided to him. So it was just, it broke my heart to see that. And I was like, you know what, if everybody in America could see these third world problems that are so basic, and we're worried about slow Wi-Fi, you know, the traffic light not turning fast enough or something, the first world problems we worry about at times, like, you wouldn't even care about them. You wouldn't even cry about them if you understood what's really going on in third world countries and countries that truly need and benefit from the services and stuff that volunteers do, whether it's Peace Corps, whether it's a NGO, or the military. Like, you know, we've got people in the Navy called Seabees that go all over Africa and they build wells, you know, so that people can have clean drinking water. And that's one of the humanitarian missions we do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm a big believer that it would be great. But as an American, we can see with COVID, you know, forced conscription of anything in a democracy, you know, it's kind of hard.
It would be a huge cultural shift, but you think about all of the kids that don't know what to do after high school. They don't think they want to go to college, but they have no conception of what that would actually be like. But they don't want to work full time. They just want to live in their parents' basement, play video games, and have no responsibilities. And then somehow, someday, magically, the light will come on and they'll know what they want to do with their life. You know, I've got a friend of mine whose son, he's a really smart kid. And he's like, I don't want to go to college just now. I'm going to go travel Europe with a backpack. And his parents are like, cool, have a good time. And he's been gone since May. He's having a blast just meeting people and just going around. It's brave. But then you really get to experience something outside of your country's norms and values, right? You see all of these other things that you want to experience. And then you can come back and say, okay, now I think I know what I want to do. You're exposed to something and having that service. You know, you think about candy stripers way back, right? When they were working in the hospitals, and then so many of them are like, I want to go into the nursing field. Or so many of them are like, oh, hell no, I don't want to do that. It's an opportunity to learn before you have to make a choice. So I think, and secondary to that is, we should all be better as humans in service to each other and in service to our world. And I think, you know, I've got three kids and all of them are wonderful people, but they're pretty self-absorbed and not like they'd knock someone over in the street to get to where they want to go, but they just have no idea of what's outside of their own life. Total first world problem is consume them. And I just think being in service to others would give you an opportunity to learn more than just what you know, see, and think you want.
So we're getting close to the end here. So let's sort of, I just love that because overseas experiences have formed me and defined me. They give me opportunity to fail forward without judgment because I'm not in the motherland or in my own hood. They've allowed me to grow exponentially, like emotionally, become emotionally honest. And here's a topic, actually, maybe for another time, because one of the things I know as a man is men are generally emotionally dishonest with themselves, right? So how do we get better at being emotionally honest with other people? And for me, that was one of the biggest fear factors, was like, I was in an environment where if I didn't open up, I was going to be on my own forever. So I had to learn to share feelings. If I want that reciprocated, then I had to learn to share feelings with other people. I love the idea of, again, it's talking about the COVID thing. That's really interesting. And David being to Djibouti, I was in Djibouti. One of the things I still do now, and I get told off for it regularly by my mum and my wife, and right, eating with my fingers. Like, I'm big on washing my hands, but I just cannot help from being overseas. That sort of, I don't know, it's something really tactile about, you can't eat baked beans with your fingers, but if you know, eating with your fingers or eating with chopsticks, those are two things that I don't let go of. So how do we there's so many subjects here, bringing this around, if you both had a superpower that could just fix some of this social dislocation that we're talking about, what would it be and what would you use it for?
I would like to have laser beam eyes that shoot compassion into people's hearts. So instead of seeing with x-ray vision, I want to shoot them at people and put compassion in their hearts. So then things would just be better.
David, that's like an ace. She just laid down a trump there, my friend. How are you going to match that?
So I was before she talked, I was thinking about empathy. Like, so how do I create empathy? So, you know, one of those things is, you know, I'd love to everybody to be able to walk a mile in somebody else's shoes. You know, because if you understand where somebody's coming from, you won't be as quick to judge. you won't, you know, you'll, your heart won't be as closed off, and you'll have more empathy for what somebody's going through. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of people that abuse systems. But those systems were in place because there was a real need. I'm not gonna lie. My son was born, you know, 6 months before I was married to my wife. We were poor college kids. You know, my wife was on WIC. You know, we were getting food stamps. We got government support for, you know, 6 months, a year or so before I finished college and got my commission, you know, because at that point I was off active duty. I was a poor college kid with you know, a girlfriend, then wife, with the one, you know, a small child, you know, trying to make it through while still pulling a part-time job and 18 credit hour courses, you know, full-time. So that's where at times I have to remember my empathy for others. Like, nobody should go through as much as what I went through. But at the same time, when somebody says, I'm working, I've got a full credit hour of 12 classes and I can't do a job and my life sucks, I'm like, let me tell you something, bud. You know, if I can get through this, 12 hours with no job should be no problem.
Yeah, it's a balance, isn't it? Well, look, thank you so much for giving up your time for us and being on the DOL Redefined and Relevant podcast. It's great hearing about your journey, David. And, you know, we'd love you to come back on again next year and maybe we can dig deeper into one of the subjects.
We need part two, food and family.
Absolutely. I'm more than happy to come back. And if you ever need any for a panel or discussion for anything else, you know, I'm more than happy to help. This was a great time getting to talk with pretty much friends.
Thanks, David. I had a good time too. Thank you.